2 Samuel chapter 14, we got through about 17 or 16 verses of this chapter on Sunday. If you weren't here, I just highly encourage you to perhaps pick that CD up or that tape up. A real key teaching, understanding, perhaps the focus that we would have to draw attention to would be verse 14 of that particular chapter, where what happened was Joab, the general or the commander of David's army, realizing that David was heartbroken over his son Absalom, and Absalom had killed his brother, or had his brother killed, Amnon, who had took advantage of his sister, Absalom's full sister, Amnon's half-sister. And so in retaliation for that, Absalom plotted to kill his brother Amnon, and thus he did that. And he fled, Absalom did, as sin always causes us to do. He fled to Geshur, which is where his grandparents lived. They were pagans. Geshur was a pagan place. And he spent several years there in exile, if you would, knowing that he had done this horrific thing, and that truly he would probably need to deal with that if he ever went back. So there he stayed, and David there being heartbroken because he hasn't seen his son. But then on the other hand, he's the king and can't really just bring him home without justification. And Joab understands the situation and sends a woman dressed in mourning clothes, grieving over a situation, she explains to David. And she tells him that she had two sons, and one of the sons killed the other, and now the family wants to kill the son that slew the other brother, and so forth. It was a fictitious story. It wasn't real. She made it up. And when David kind of moved with compassion towards this woman, said, well, okay, we'll just pardon your other son that killed your other son. I mean, we'll just let it go. Then she brings up this issue with David. Why have you pardoned my son when your son is in exile? And she says this in verse 14. She says, for we must needs die and are as spilt water on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. In other words, we're all going to die. And her point is, you know, what good is it to have Absalom die for his brother's death? I mean, they'll just both be dead if that's the case. But she says, neither doth God respect any person, yet he devises a means that his banished be not expelled from him. And she had pointed out to David that he was making a faulty decision based upon the fact that his own son remained banished while he forgave this woman's son. And we talked about that on Sunday. And we're going to pick up the story in verse 17, because the woman, she explains this to David, and David catches on to something as she's finishing up her little talk with him. All of a sudden, it strikes David, it's kind of funny that this woman would have this story that's so closely linked with her son's situation and his brother who he killed. Is this just a coincidence? You know, David's starting to put the pieces together. And the woman finished up her discussion, and David then, you see, says in verse 18, the king answered and said unto the woman, hide not from me, I pray thee, the thing that I shall ask thee. And the woman said, let my lord the king now speak. And the king said, verse 19, is not the hand of Joab with thee in all this? David says, hey, did Joab put you up to this? Is this my general Joab? Now, many commentators believe Joab was standing there in the room, like, you know, kind of prodding the woman, giving her kind of a wink here, and, you know, as she's telling the story, you know, because he planted all those things in her thinking that she would share with David. So David says, hey, did Joab put you up to this? Is this Joab's doing? You see. Hide it not from me, I pray thee. You see, and he says, and the woman says, well, as thy soul liveth, my lord the king, none can turn to the right hand nor to the left aught that my lord the king hath spoken. For thy servant Joab, he bade me, and he put all these words in my mouth of thine handmaid. Yep. That's the short answer. Yeah, it was Joab. He did it. He told me what to say. To fetch about this form of speech hath thy servant Joab done this thing. And my Lord is wise according to the wisdom of an angel of God to know all things that are in the earth. So she says, wow, you're smart. You're really sharp, David, to know that Joab must have put me up to this. Now, many have wrestled with the question, was it David's right or was it his duty or was he in the right to pardon this woman's son, and was he in the right to pardon his own son, Absalom? And the emphatic answer is no. He is not above the law. And people say, well, wait a minute now. David was forgiven for his sin and murder, right? Yep, he was. God forgave him, and he was broken and contrite and repented, confessed. His bones were aching and his body was broken over this whole thing. He was a broken man over that. God forgave him. But why then doesn't David then have the right to pardon his son? Because David is not God. The law was clear. Back in Genesis 9, it began with Noah. If a man sheds a man's blood, by his blood shall he die. In other words, you kill a man on purpose, murder him, you shed a man's blood purposely, your blood must be shed. Now, people say, well, wait a minute now. I thought you said David didn't, I mean, he didn't die. No. God forgave him. Now, don't mix this up. David didn't have the right to forgive Absalom, but God did. Do you follow? And it's not the same thing. A man forgiving another man, another person, especially his own son, which of course he wants to restore and forgive him. He wants to let it go, if you would. But he's wrestling with this, as we will see. David's got a tough thing ahead of him here. He knows better than this. He knows better. And watch what happens here. David then turns to Joab and says, behold, I have done this thing. Go therefore, bring the young man Absalom again. Go ahead and bring him. Now, one thing you don't see happening here or previously with the woman is David consoling with the Lord about this. He's not asking God about this at all. He hears from Joab that really in an indirect way with this woman, that he should go ahead and forgive Absalom and bring him home. Now, why is it that Joab's so concerned about Absalom coming home and being forgiven for this sin and this breaking of the law? Why is he so concerned? Because Joab's guilty of murder. Remember? Remember Abner? And he's not the only one. Joab's got a little problem here. He's got a habit of doing this. He's been killing people a lot in this way. And you see Joab going, go ahead, forgive him. Let him come home. And if he will do this, if David will do this, then Joab is obviously also going to be off the hook. I don't have to feel bad about my thing. If you let Absalom off the hook, then I'm okay too. You're okay, I'm okay. See, that'll be a good thing. Was it? No. And here's the interesting thing. When you look at this, watch what happens. Joab fell to the ground, verse 22, on his face and bowed himself and thanked the king. And Joab said, today thy servant knoweth that I have found grace in thy sight, my lord. Who has found grace? I have. Why? Because you let Absalom off the hook, which means I am. Follow? O king, in that the king hath fulfilled the request of his servant, you're going to let Absalom come home. That means that I'm okay too. So Joab arose and went to Geshur and brought Absalom to Jerusalem. And the king said, let him turn to his own house and let him not see my face. Huh? So David says, bring him home, but don't let him come to the palace. I don't want to see him. I don't want to see his face. I don't want him to see me. This isn't forgiveness. This is David trying to compromise the law. He knows he can't really forgive the debt that Absalom owes because the law forbids it. So what he's doing is a compromise move. He can come home, but he can't come back into the family, really. He can stay away from the palace, is what he says. So Absalom returned to his own house and saw not the king's face. He wouldn't be allowed to see David, his father. But, verse 25, in all Israel there was none to be such praised as Absalom for his beauty. Absalom was a beauty. I mean, that's the best thing you want to say to a man, you know. But the Bible's clear. This guy was a beautiful person. He was one of the beautiful people, you know. He was just styling. You know what I mean? I mean, he just looked like, you know, a movie star. You know, whoever the movie stars are that you think are good looking, he was that, you know. I don't even know who movie stars are. People say, you know who this guy is? Uh-uh. Who is that? You know. But the point is, he was a good looking guy. From the sole of his foot, even to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. Whoa. This guy was one looker. Absalom. Huh. And the people praised him. There was none such in all of Israel to be praised like Absalom. Everybody thought he's the ticket, man. He's the next president. Or in this case, the king. And the people wanted Absalom. He was good looking. I mean, it didn't seem to matter to them that he was a liar and a murderer. Things haven't changed much. Have they? I mean, people really wanted him to be in power, as we'll see here in a minute. Now, it says in verse 26, and this is interesting that this is in here. I mean, I don't even know why it's there, really, but it's interesting. When he pulled his hair or cut his hair, when he got a haircut, it was every year. He got a haircut once a year, whether he needed it or not. And his hair, listen to this, his hair was heavy on him. He's Fabio. He's just this guy with this long hair. Good looking guy, you know. So he pulled it every year because the hair was heavy on him. Therefore, he pulled it. He weighed the hair. Now, who weighs their hair? He does. This guy's on an ego trip, somewhat. Don't you think? I mean, when you get a haircut, honey, weigh that, will you? And the reason I say honey is because my honey cuts my hair. My wife cuts my hair, you know. But I don't weigh it. It's not worth weighing, you know, when I get a haircut. But he weighed his hair. And the weight of his hair was 200 shekels after the king's weight. Now, that's about 5 pounds of hair. Dude. I mean, it's like, hey, I got some hair. Now, isn't this funny that this is here? What's it there for? I don't know. It's for you guys that don't have hair, just to let you know that somebody's got hair. You need to talk to Absalom. He had something going on with his hair. Now, unto Absalom there were born 3 sons and 1 daughter whose name was Tamar. Remember, Tamar was his sister. So he named his daughter after her. And she was a woman of fair countenance, like his sister was, a beauty, you see. Now, it's interesting that later on, in fact, over a chapter or two in chapter 18, you'll see that it says that he had 3 sons here, but none of them are mentioned. In fact, he has no sons in the genealogies whatsoever. So he either had 3 sons and they died young, you know, or something, because they're not listed. And I find this is interesting. Absalom is a man that was fruitless. His sons didn't make it. He had no fruit to show for his life. His genealogy ended with himself. And so it's interesting, when you look at his genealogy, you won't find his sons. So Absalom dwelt 2 full years in Jerusalem and saw not the king's face. He lived in his own place for 2 years, never saw David. And therefore Absalom sent for Joab to have sent him to the king, but he would not come. And when he sent a second time, he would not come again. In other words, Absalom's saying, hey, I need to see the king. You know, it's time's up, 2 years. And Joab wouldn't even respond to him. Interesting. He's the one that wanted him to come back. What's up with this? Well, Joab knows who Absalom is. He wanted him to come back so Joab could feel better, but he really knows better than to have him come back. And he knows he's trouble, and he doesn't even respond to him. Therefore, Absalom proves his own character out here by doing this. Therefore, he said unto his servant, see Joab's field near mine. He hath barley there. Go and set it on fire. You know, if he's not going to come, set his field on fire. That'll get his attention. And Absalom's servant set the field on fire. And then Joab arose. That got his attention. You see, and came to Absalom unto his house and said unto him, wherefore have the servant set a field on fire? What'd you set my field on fire for? You know, long-haired nut, you know, he says. And Absalom answered Joab, behold, I sent unto thee, saying, come hither. I told you to come here. You getting the idea that Absalom's a little arrogant? I told you to come. Told you twice. So you didn't come, so I set your field on fire. Wow. Did you get the memo? You know, I sent the memo. Did you get it? Field's on fire. You know, wow. So I said, come here, that I may send thee to the king to say, wherefore am I come to from Geshur? He says, I told you to come so I could tell you to go talk to the king and ask him why I even came from Geshur. It had been good for me to have been there still. Been better for me to stay in that pagan place. Now, therefore, let me see the king's face. And if there be any iniquity in me, let him kill me. So he says, so let me see him. And if he finds anything at fault in me, then let him kill me. He knows he's not going to, doesn't he? Of course he does. He's already been allowed to come home with no penalty whatsoever. So now, of course, hey, go ahead, you know, have a court session, and if he finds any fault in me, then have him kill me. He knows better than that. He knows he's not going to do that. So Joab came to the king and told him, and when he had called for Absalom, he came to the king and bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom, which meant he restored him. Now, people say, oh, well, Absalom got down on his knees and bowed down. Well, this is the normal thing you do for a king. There's no repentance here. And there's no asking for forgiveness here. None. Zero, you see. He's just doing what any one of the subjects of the king would do. If he hadn't done this, it would be a direct violation and an act of rebellion against the king openly. Just bowing down and saying, oh, hi, king, you know, and David kisses him, you know, it's a royal type of pomp and circumstance that's going on here, nothing more. And we see that in reality here in the next chapter. It came to pass after this that Absalom prepared him chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. Huh. Now, remember, Samuel had prophesied that the kings to come would multiply unto them horses and chariots, and they weren't supposed to do that. And here we see the first thing Absalom does after he's restored is he gets himself a bunch of horses and chariots and 50 men to run before him. Gets a whole entourage together. Why? Well, we'll see here. By the way, Psalm 20, verse 7, interesting psalm that I'll read just the quote to you about that. It says this. David wrote this psalm, by the way. He says, some trust in chariots and some in horses. We will remember the name of the Lord. David was a man who would remember God's name. Absalom was going to trust in chariots and horses. Because really, truly, we have no indication or evidence anywhere that Absalom really knew the Lord at all. None. Now, watch what happens. Absalom, verse 2, rose up early and stood beside the way of the gate. And it was so that when any man that had a controversy came to the king for judgment, then Absalom called unto him and said, "Of what city art thou?" And he said, "Thy servant is one of the tribes of Israel." And Absalom said unto him, "Well, see, thy matters are good and right, but there is no man deputied of the king to hear thee." The people would come to the city gate. Remember, the city gate is where the court sessions were held. It was kind of where all the civil business took place, was at the city gate. So Absalom gets himself positioned there, watching for the people that are coming to bring their cases before the king. And he doesn't let them get that far. He kind of heads them off and says, "Hey, where are you from, and what's the beef you got?" And they tell him, and he says to them, "Oh, man, your cause is right. You have a good case here. Too bad there's nobody to judge it." Is that true? No. But he's giving them the impression that that's so. He's undermining his father. And Absalom said, "Moreover, oh, that I were made judge in the land, that every man which hath any suit or cause might come unto me, and I would do him justice." Boy, if I was only the judge, you know, I would hear your case. You've got a good case. You know, I'd probably just judge in your favor on that. What a sly dog this guy is. He's telling the people that really, in no uncertain terms, that David's not doing his job as king. And if I was the ruler, I would certainly do you right. I'd be just, and I'd hear your case, and I'd do you good, you know. Now, this guy is such a phony, and he's telling the people exactly what they want to hear, and they love it. He's a classic politician. In fact, he's been noted by many Bible scholars as a demagogue. What's that, you say? What's a demagogue? Demagogue usually falls into the political category. He's a guy who, like what Absalom's doing here, will tell the people what they want to hear so that they'll vote for him. But I like what one guy said. I found this. This is great. If there was ever a guy to lead the people astray, it's Absalom. I mean, really, right? I mean, this guy's, he's not the man to lead people. He'll lead them astray. But this guy said, this is what a demagogue is. One who preaches doctrine he knows to be untrue to men he knows to be idiots. That's a demagogue. In other words, he shares things he knows isn't true. It's not true stuff he's saying, but he knows the people he's saying it to are idiots, so it doesn't matter. Now, that's not a reflection on you guys. I mean, politicians do that, you know. But I'll tell you what, they've got a point in some cases. The masses really are idiotic sometimes, and we see that. Again, times haven't changed much since this particular deal took place all the way back there here in 2 Samuel, has it? Won't our people in our nation just about put up with anything? Won't they? As long as the economy's good? I mean, it's true. I mean, you just tell us it's okay. Tell us we're going to be fine and do what you want. That's about it, you see. And that's what Absalom's doing. He's telling them what he knows they want to hear, you see. Now, he's a picture, by the way. He's kind of a type of one who's going to be like this. Absalom, good looking, you know, weighs his hair, you know, the whole deal. He's just this guy that's got so much charisma, and all the people are flocking to him. He's telling them what they want to hear, that he's going to fix everything if he became the man in charge, right? Who does that sound like? The Antichrist. David, the picture of Jesus Christ, the son of David, if you would. David, the one who is a man after God's own heart. Absalom's never called that. And Absalom here typifies that there in Revelation 13:3. It talks about this one who will come. Let me just read that to you, just real quick. It's just a couple of verses. Listen to this guy. I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death. And his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. And they worshipped the dragon, which gave power unto the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast? And who is able to make war with him? And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. And power was given unto him to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God and to blaspheme his name. Antichrist that Revelation chapter 13 speaks of is a man who opens his mouth and blasphemes and speaks lies. But we also know from Daniel's account and others that this guy is going to be so charming while he does it. He's going to be, just like Absalom, he's blaspheming his father's name, isn't he? He's tearing it down so nicely. And guys, this is something, I look at Absalom and I go, ooh, there's people in the church like this. That tear people down so nicely. You notice them? You ever see them? They say little things that just tear people apart so neat and tidy. You hardly even know they're doing it. You see, it's really tricky. Be careful. Watch that. Watch what comes out of your mouth. Absalom here knows what he's doing. And most people that do this know what they're doing. They know it, you see. Now, watch this. Got quiet in here. And so he goes on. And he says, verse 5, and it was so that when any man came nigh to him to do him obeisance, watch this, they came and tried to bow down to him. Watch what he does. He put forth his hand and took him and kissed him. He wouldn't let the person bow down. He'd pull him up to him and give him a kiss. Now, a person in stately position like Absalom wouldn't do that. But he's doing it. Why? To win them over. To win the people over. And on this manner, verse 6, did Absalom do all Israel that came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. He treated them in such a way that they felt like he really cared about them. And that the king didn't. Because they never got that far. He kind of cut them off. And it came to pass, verse 7, after 40 years. Now, your Bible may correctly render this 4 years. It's not 40, it's four. 40 years may be what's being referred to back when David was anointed. But even that is probably a stretch. More than likely, this is just a scribe's misprint. And does that happen? Yeah. There's several of them in the scriptures. Doesn't change the context of the Bible. Just happens to be 4 years that he was doing this, not 40. Obviously, David would be dead and gone if it was 40. So, 4 years that Absalom said unto the king, I pray thee, let me go and pay my vow, which I have vowed unto the Lord in Hebron. Huh. Let me go pay my vow in Hebron, Absalom says to David. Like he's got a vow to keep, you know. For thy servant vowed a vow while I abode at Geshur. Did not. You were living the pagan life with your grandparents in Geshur. You weren't making any vows there. He's just lying, you see. Why? Because he wants to start something up in Hebron. That's why. It says, I abode there and I made a vow there. And if the Lord shall bring me again indeed to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord. So I'll go make my vow, and then I'll be back to serve God. And the king said unto him, go in peace. So he arose and went to Hebron. Now, Hebron is where Absalom's going to start his rebellion. And there's some real interesting connotations to that. This is where David began as king. And now his son Absalom's going there purposely to start his rebellion to take the kingdom. So it's a slam against him. But Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes, verse 10 of Israel, saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom reigneth in Hebron. As soon as you start hearing the trumpets blow, you guys shout all over the place, all over the region, that Absalom is king now. He reigns in Hebron. And with Absalom went 200 men out of Jerusalem that were called, and they went in their simplicity, and they knew not anything, meaning not that they were simple-minded, but that they didn't know what was going on. They followed him, but didn't know what he was up to. He's kind of leading this 200 men out of Jerusalem to Hebron, but they don't have a clue what he's up to. So Absalom sent for Ahithophel. Ahithophel. Do you know who Ahithophel is? It's David's counselor. His own close advisor. He sends for Ahithophel the Gilonite, David's counselor, from his city, even from Gilhol, while he offered sacrifices. And the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom. Now, why in the world would Ahithophel go join forces with Absalom against his own king, David? Well, here's the interesting thing about Ahithophel. Ahithophel is the grandfather of Bathsheba. And many believe that Ahithophel never forgave David for taking his daughter, or his granddaughter, literally, and tainting her, spoiling her, by having this adulterous affair with her, remember, and has always vowed vengeance against King David. And that's why he turned on him. But this is a Judas act right here. Interestingly, Ahithophel, as you'll see in the next chapter or so, Ahithophel does exactly what Judas did. What? Kills himself after he betrays his king. It's an amazing thing. But this is an act of treason, just like Judas turning on Jesus, you see. And there came a messenger to David, verse 13, saying, the hearts of the men of Israel are after Absalom. And David said unto all his servants that were with him at Jerusalem, arise and let us flee, for we shall not else escape from Absalom. Interestingly, you don't have to go there, but you can read it later, but I'll read just parts of it to you. Psalm 3 is titled A Psalm of David When He Fled from Absalom, his son. It's a familiar one. I'll read it to you. Lord, how are they increased that trouble me? Many are they that rise up against me. David wrote many psalms during this time that Absalom, his own son, was trying to hunt him down. Many there be which say of my soul, there is no help for him in God. But thou, O Lord, art a shield for me, my glory and the lifter of my head. I cried unto the Lord with my voice, and he heard me out of his holy hill. I laid me down and slept. I awaked, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people that have set themselves against me round about. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for thou hast smitten all mine enemies upon the cheekbone. Thou hast broken the teeth of the ungodly. Salvation belongeth unto the Lord. Thy blessing is upon thy people. David never forgot that the Lord was with him, even though he was in this place of destitution, really, and everybody knew it. He was fleeing again, just like he did with Saul. But this time it's his own son. What a tragic thing. But David isn't giving up. And people say, why is he leaving Jerusalem? Why didn't he stay and fight? Because he knew that Absalom had already gotten too far with this thing, and that many would die, and he was trying to protect the people. David wasn't afraid. David was a warrior. he was a fighter. He wasn't afraid for himself, but he had family. He knew that Absalom had already killed one brother, Amnon. He had his other sons with him, who Absalom would certainly think nothing of killing them. So he's protecting, you know, the people, his family, and so forth. And this is interesting. David was a man who had won the hearts of the people by sacrifice and service. Absalom, he won the people over by manufacturing an image, didn't he? Built himself an image. David was a hero, wasn't he? Killed Goliath, fought many battles. Absalom, he was a celebrity. Just a celebrity. There's no comparison between these two. David, I believe, knows that. He knows that Absalom is really no match in that sense, but he loves his son. And that's another reason why he's fleeing here. So he flees, as we see, and arises and takes off. And David said, "Let's go, you see, arise and let us flee, for we shall not else escape from Absalom. Make speed to depart, lest he overtake us suddenly and bring evil upon us and smite the city with the edge of the sword." And the king's servants said unto the king, "Behold, thy servants are ready to do whatsoever my lord the king shall appoint." That's a great verse. That's how those who know the greater than David, Jesus, should respond whenever he wants to do something. "Hey, your servants are ready to do whatsoever my lord the king shall appoint. Whatever you want to do, Lord, I'll do it. I'm there. I'm with you." You see, this is what the church should be. This is what the church should respond like when the call comes, when the word is shared, when the command is given, whatever it might be that we hear from the Lord. This should be the response. "Okay, Lord, whatever you want to do, your servants are ready." What if that was true? Wow. What if that was true in the church? A lot would get done, don't you think? Man. Instead of, "Well, Lord, we heard you, but you know, we got things to do. We're busy." Now, I always think about that. Why is it that the people don't respond to the Lord this way? "We're busy. Got other things to do." And I wonder if that's going to wash when we're standing in front of the Lord. "I didn't go, Lord. I didn't do that. I was kind of busy." "Oh. I guess you were busy, weren't you? That was important what you were doing too." I always think, wow, that is not going to stand up. And it really doesn't stand up now, you know. Whatever we put in front of this attitude that these people have, it doesn't stand up. There's no reason, you see. No reason that's good enough. "And the king went forth, and all his household after him, and the king left 10 women, which were concubines, to keep the house." These women are going to be violated by Absalom later, just like it was foretold that would happen. Because David had taken another man's wife and had many wives and concubines, the word came, didn't it? "Your own wives are going to be taken. Your own women that you are now taking really unlawfully, David, they're going to be taken. And it's not only going to be someone taking them, it's going to be Absalom." Whoo. This is a terrible thing, isn't it? It's going to happen in chapter 17 where David actually goes into these concubines that are left behind. "Now, the king went forth, and all the people after him, and tarried in a place that was far off." They took off in the wilderness. And David was familiar with the wilderness, by the way. He had all those years of running from Saul, didn't he? He had all kinds of hiding places. He was equipped for the wilderness. And it says that all his servants passed on beside him, and all the Cherethites and all the Palethites and the Gittites, 600 men which came after him from Gath passed on before the king. And then said the king to Ittai the Gittite, "Wherefore goest thou also with us?" Now these guys are from Gath. These are Philistines. These are men that have been involved with David after he became king. Now, David had a pretty strong name. He had a pretty good reputation among the Philistines, don't you think? Why? Well, he took out Goliath, didn't he? You don't think the Philistines had legends about David, songs written about him and all the rest? Boy, David took out Goliath. You know, I mean, they knew who he was. After he became king, we find that many of the Philistines followed after him, joined with him, wanted to follow after David because they were so blown away with his ministry as the king. So these guys, there's 600 of them that have come. And David says, "Wherefore goest thou with us? Return to thy place and abide with the king, for thou art a stranger and also an exile." You're an exile too if you follow us. You know, you don't need to come with us, but watch this. "Whereas thou camest but yesterday," you just got here, "should I this day make thee go up and down with us, seeing I go whither I may return and take back thy brethren? Mercy and truth be with thee." Go back. You don't have to come with us, is what David's saying to these guys. You don't put yourself in the line. You can go back to Jerusalem. You can be with Absalom. He'll use you. Go back. And watch this. Attai, verse 21, answered the king and said, "As the Lord liveth, and as my lord the king liveth, surely in what place my lord the king shall be, whether in death or life, even there also will thy servant be." That's quite a statement for a Philistine, a Gentile, to make to a Jewish king. Reminds us of the church again. Reminds us also of Ruth, doesn't it? Remember when Ruth was told by Naomi, her mother-in-law, "Hey, go back to the Moabites. Go back and worship, you know, your own gods and all the rest. You know, you don't have to come with me." And Ruth said, "What? Wherever you go, I'm going. If you go and die, I'll go and die. I want your God to be my God." You remember that? Remember also the centurion who came to Jesus with his servant being sick. Remember him? And Jesus said, "Well, I'll come with you to your house." And he says, "No, you don't need to do that. Just say the word, and my servant will be healed. Because I'm a man under command, too. I know I tell people to go do things, and they do it." He says, You just tell your angels to do it, they'll do it. Jesus said, "I like it." That's faith. That's faith. You don't see this very often in the scripture. This is one of those places where these guys say, "We don't care where you're going, we're going. Living, dying, doesn't matter to us. We're going to be with you," you see. And David said to Attai, "Go and pass over." And Attai, the Gittite, passed over. He finally convinced him to go back. And his men and all the little ones that were with him. He had not only his soldiers, this guy, Attai, but he had all his family. He had packed up everything to follow David, you see. That willing heart that would go follow him anywhere. And all the country wept with a loud voice. Amazing. And all the people passed over. The king also himself passed over the brook Kidron. Interesting. And all the people passed over toward the way of the wilderness. The brook Kidron, if you know the geography right there in Jerusalem, the brook Kidron really runs right down the bottom of the hill where the Temple Mount is. Temple Mount's up top. Right there is the brook Kidron. Usually it's not much of a brook, but during this time of year when David was fleeing Jerusalem, it would have been kind of a torrent. Being kind of, you know, there's bridges and so forth you could go across. But this would have been kind of flowing. And they crossed the Kidron weeping, all the people and David. And they would have made their way across the Kidron Valley right there, right heading up to the Mount of Olives, first, though, passing through or at least by the Garden of Gethsemane. Interesting. So as David is realizing that his sinful son is really beyond help, he's lost him. As he goes from Jerusalem across that Kidron Valley and heads up to the Mount of Olives, passing through or at least by the Garden of Gethsemane, he's weeping. just like Jesus on that night when he'd be betrayed. Just like David's being betrayed by Ahithophel here, and his own son, sinful Absalom, is turning on him, David would cross over that same place on his way to the garden where he would what? Weep. Great tears would fall as he grieved over what he was going to do. Amazing. The parallels are kind of staggering in a sense. So he's on his way towards the wilderness. You can read about that in John 18, verse 1, where Jesus goes across there and all the rest. But watch this. Zadok also and all the Levites were with him bearing the ark. They brought the ark out there, out of the tabernacle. You know, there's no temple yet. Don't forget, there's just the tabernacle there pitched on that little mount there. There was no temple mount or anything. It's just a mountain right there, and that's where the tabernacle was. And they grabbed the Ark of the Covenant and brought it with them, and they sat down the Ark of God, and Abiathar went up until all the people had gone passing out of the city. And the king said unto Zadok, carry back the Ark of God into the city. Don't bring it with us. Don't bring the Ark. Take it back to the Holy of Holies. Don't. Now, David's learned a little bit about the Ark, hasn't he? Remember Ahio and his brother Uzzah? Remember those guys? And they tried to bring that Ark back on the cart, remember? It was a problem. They tried to. David learning about the Ark, and he says, take it back to the Holy of Holies where it belongs. And what's David saying here? Well, he's saying a couple of things, I believe. The Ark is not a good luck charm. We don't just drag the Ark out of the Holy of Holies and bring it with us and think it's going to bring us luck or something. He knows that God will meet him where? Anywhere he is. He doesn't need the Ark. Did he have the Ark out in the wilderness when Saul pursued him? No. And God met him, didn't he? Protected him, watched over him constantly. David knows God's going to watch over them in the wilderness. They don't need the ark to be brought along physically. He knows that the ark's not going to do it for him. It's not a good luck charm, you see. So he says, take it back. And the king says, you know, go ahead and take it back. If I shall find favor, he says, verse 25 continues, in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me again and show me both it and his habitation. If he's going to find favor with me, he's going to find favor with me. David understands another thing that's going on here, and that is he's being disciplined. Well, how does he know that? Because he was told. It's a promise. He was told by Nathan, the sword shall never depart from your house, David, because of what you've done. You're going to pay the consequences for this the rest of your life. So would it be out of line for David to think otherwise than he's going to deal with some issues? Of course not. He knows he's going to be dealing with things. He says, if God finds favor with me, then he'll bring me back. If he wants to discipline me to death, then he will. But he also knew this, that his kingdom should never cease. His kingdom, David's kingdom. The promised Messiah was going to come from his lineage, and he knew that as well. But he says, but if he thus say, I have no delight in thee, behold, here am I. Let him do with me as seemeth good unto him. If the Lord doesn't want me to come back, I won't. If he wants me to, I will. If he wants to protect me out there, he's going to. And if he doesn't, then I guess we'll die in the wilderness. But bringing the ark with us or not isn't going to make any difference. You know? And that's the truth. You know, you can grab little things if you want to grab onto them, but they don't do any good. You know, people grab onto crosses when they go certain places. I took my cross with me. You know, well, that's fine. You know, I felt some evil, so, you know. I held my cross out there. Well, did you feel better? Yeah, I did. Okay. but it wasn't doing any good. God's the one that does good. He's got the power. You know, something you wear around your neck doesn't have any power, you see. So, and that's just a little tidbit for you. I'm sure none of you do that. But some of you might. But the thing is that the power, David said, the power is not in whether I bring something or don't bring something or whether I've done this or that. I am dealing with consequences for my sin, and the Lord will either spare me or he'll take my life. One way or the other, I'm okay. I'm okay with it. That's a heavy statement. That's a mature statement. The king said also, verse 27, unto Zadok the priest, art thou a seer? Return into the city in peace, and your two sons with you, Ahimaaz, thy son, and Jonathan, the son of Abiathar. He sends them back to take the ark, but he says, stay there. Why? They're going to be spies. He says, see, I will tarry in the plain of the wilderness until there come word from you to certify me. So you just tell me what's going on, and I'll wait to hear from you in the wilderness. Zadok, therefore, and Abiathar carried the ark of God again to Jerusalem, and they tarried there. And David went up by the ascent of the Mount Olivet. There he is, heading up the Mount of Olives, and he wept. David wept again up on top of the Mount of Olives as he went up and had his head covered, and he went barefoot. These are mourning, grieving times for him, which is what the barefoot and the covered head. He's just, he's leaving Jerusalem, fleeing again into the wilderness, you see, feeling the weight, literally, of what his sinful life has accomplished in this consequence that he's paying. And it's heavy on him. And I've done that. Well, it's not that I've gone barefoot with my head covered. But I felt the weight of God's hand on my life over things that I did in my youth. Well, what do you mean? Are you still paying for things? Absolutely. Absolutely. There's not one person here who won't instantaneously look back on something that you did without feeling grieved. Is there? Anybody? I'm still dealing with that. It's not that I'm not forgiven. I am. But there are times something can trigger it. Someone can say something. I can be sitting at a stoplight and a song in the car next to me that's turned up, you know. You know, boom, boom, boom. And it's some song, you know, that it sparks something in me, and immediately I go somewhere in my thinking, and it just kills me. You? Been there? This is kind of what David's doing. He's got his feet bare, his head covered, and he's aching inside because the consequences of what his life has now come to is being revealed and realized, and it's hurting. And again, we're forgiven. We're not going to pay eternally for the sins of our life. But make no mistake, there's a cost with everything we've done, everything we do. That's why the Lord says, stop it. Stop sinning now so that you don't deal with any more of this stuff later. You know, I always tell my kids, you have no idea the grief you're sparing yourselves by getting saved at a young age and walking with the Lord. Wow, do you have any idea how much problem and grief and agony you're sparing yourself? Whew. You know. And the Lord has made fruitful many of the afflictions and problems and things that I've done wrong in my life. But there's not one of them I wish I could take and make it not so. Not one. Not one I say, well, I'm glad I did that one. None of them, you see. And David feels the weight on his head and on his shoulders. And all the people that were with him covered every man his head, and they went up weeping as they went up. The whole place is feeling it. It's just sad. And one told David, saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. Now, this would be a blow. His closest counselor, he just found out, has conspired to turn against him. Now, I need to say this. That probably all of us has experienced, at least at some point or another, somebody close to you that turned on you. Right? And again, this is sadly true in the church. There are people that turn on you, turn on me, even in the body of Christ, and it hurts. Especially if somebody's close to you. It just hurts you. But I want to ask you, what do you do when somebody real close to you turns on you or hurts you? Well, we're supposed to do what David did. What's that? Well, look. He hears that Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom, and David said, O Lord, verse 31, I pray thee, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. Now, he's not praying against Ahithophel. He's praying against his counsel. And the point is that he's praying. You pray when someone turns on you. And, again, verse 32, it came to pass that when David was come to the top of the mount, he worshiped God. He prayed and he worshiped. Well, that's what we do anyway. Yep. And it's no different when someone turns on you, when someone kind of stabs you in the back, if you would, kind of pulls a fast one on you or whatever it might be. Someone hurts you. You pray and you worship, just like David did. He prays and worships. And behold, it says, verse 32, Hushai, the Archite, came to meet him with his coat rent and the earth upon his head. Means he's been on the road. Unto whom David said, if thou passest on with me, then thou shalt be a burden unto me. If you go with me, you're going to be a burden. Now, what does this mean? Well, Hushai might have been an older man and might have slowed things down. He's a friend of David's. He's a follower of David's. But David says, if you come with me, then you're going to be a burden. But if you return to the city and say unto Absalom, I will be thy servant, O king, as I have been thy father's servant hitherto, so will I now also be thy servant. Then thou mayest thou for me defeat the counsel of Ahithophel. In other words, if you will go back and be a spy, then you can do me some good because you can kind of counteract what Ahithophel is going to counsel here. And it says, and hast thou not there with thee Zadok and Abiathar the priest? They're there with you. Therefore it shall be that what things soever thou shalt hear out of the king's house, thou shalt tell it to Zadok and Abiathar the priest. Behold, they have there with them their two sons, Ahimaaz and Zadok's son, and Jonathan, Abiathar's son, and by them you shall send unto me everything that you can hear. So Hushai's David's friend came unto the city, and Absalom unto Jerusalem. This is a sad story to me in so many ways, but David has not quit, and he is using, people say he's using his friends to accomplish things, you know, against his own son. Well, yeah, but his son's the one that's in rebellion. He's the king. And here's the interesting thing. To me, I look at this, and I look at David, his tears as he climbs the mountain, and his tears as he went over the Kidron Valley, and how it pictures Christ and all the rest. And the Bible, guys, is full of tears. You know that. David is weeping a lot. We see the Apostle Paul weeping. We see Jesus weeping. Men in the Bible wept. And it's a sad story in many ways, this one. But it's not over yet. We kind of leave this chapter in the midst of David leaving and seeming like Absalom's getting the better of his father, but it's not going to work. And this is kind of how this world is left, in a sense, isn't it? Kind of looking like the enemy's getting the best of things, but he's not. See, David has left Jerusalem, so to speak, but he'll be back, won't he? Jesus has left the earth, so to speak. but he'll be back. And this world is left in kind of a disarray, just like this seemingly is. But I like what Tozer said. He said the Bible was written in tears, and to tears it will yield its best treasures. If you don't read the Bible occasionally with tears running down your face, you see, you're not getting the full brunt of the treasure that's there. It's a sad thing what's going on here, but the sadness is a result of sin. It's a result of rebellion. It's a result of even David's own lustful behavior. And he's paying for that. He's dealing with that in his life. Many of us are too. But this isn't over yet. This isn't done. This isn't the final deal, you see. There's more to come. And in your life, in my life, right now, we can look at this and we can say, man, I'm relating to that part of this story where, man, there's trouble and I'm feeling it and I'm feeling the weight of it. I am experiencing that heaviness upon me over my sin. And this is the good news for us. This is the best part for us. That scenario, that particular issue, whatever you're experiencing right now or going through, that's not unique to you, you know. Paul says that we're all dealing with that. It's a common thing. There's no temptation that comes to you that isn't common to all men. But here's the thing. Whether it's this issue that you're dealing with now or the one you'll deal with next week, and you will, isn't that something? You can confess all your sin today, and there'll be more next week to deal with. So it's not that we're going to get away from sin. Now, guys, some of you have, I think, asked this or are trying to ask the Lord to make it so that you don't experience sin anymore. And that won't happen. You know, I used to do this. I used to pray, Lord, just don't make that appealing anymore to me. I don't want to be tempted anymore. So just don't give me any temptation. And the Lord said, no, you're a sinful creature. You have a sinful nature. You're going to be tempted. However, there's a way of escape for you, just as Paul describes. You can take the way out of that temptation, but the temptation will be there. I won't take that away. Now, why? Why won't he? Because you and I have to exercise faith. Faith, of all things. It's faith we have to engage in order to overcome. This is what has overcome the world. What? Even our faith. You can overcome by faith. Without it, nothing's going to happen, you see. So don't try and get away from having anything ever tempt you. It's going to happen. You're going to be tempted. You can walk down the street. You can walk in the supermarket. You can walk down the magazine aisle. You can do whatever you normally do in life, and something's going to come at you to tempt you. Right? And you're not going to get away from that. So what's the key? Take the way of escape. Paul says, take every thought captive, bring it to Christ, say, Lord, I know you don't want me to think about that anymore. Here it is. See, take it from me and deal with it in that way. And he can deal with it for you, you see. But the good news for me is it's an issue this week. It'll be an issue next week. It was an issue last week. But you know what I did? Last week, I went to the table. You know what I'm going to do this week? Go to the table. Guess what I'm going to do next week? Go to the table. Why? Confess. Why? Because John tells me in 1 John that if I will confess my sin, he is faithful and just to cleanse me and wash away that stuff. And I then have this restoration. I have this cleansing. Not that I'm forgiven from that sin for the first time. It's been forgiven for 2,000 years. But when I go to the table, I experience the cleansing of it. Jesus would put it this way. Hey, I'm going to wash your feet, he told the disciples. Peter said, no, you don't. You're not going to wash my feet. And Jesus said, hey, if I don't wash your feet, you don't have any part with me. And Peter said, well, then give me a bath. You know, give me a whole bath then. And Jesus said, no, you don't need a bath. Meaning you don't need to get baptized again because you've sinned, but your feet are dirty because that is the part of you that has come into contact with the world. And you need your feet washed. And some of us, dare I say, all of us, have had parts of us come in contact with the world. And therefore, we need our feet washed. Which is really what communion does. It's just a foot washing. It cleanses that part. And you confess that part that's been exposed to the world, and guess what? He's faithful and just to cleanse it, wash it. Nothing like it. Nothing like coming away from the table and going, confessed, cleansed, washed. Whew, nice. That's the good news. In the midst of all this, that's the good news. See? So, let's do that. Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for David and the experience that he goes through in these stories, that we know we don't have to go through all that. We can learn from him. We can learn from the stories and the examples in the scriptures. Even as Paul declared, these things are for our learning and examples for us, Lord, that we don't have to go through the terrible trials and issues that others did, because we can see the results. And we know you're faithful, Father. And we realize that many of us tonight are sitting here sinking low because of the weight of sin is on us. And you don't want us to be in that particular state. You want us to be released and free, cleansed and washed. I pray that, Lord, as confessions made tonight, even at your table, you would bless the cup, bless the bread. Because that truly is a reminder of what your body broken and the blood shed accomplished on the cross. And that's what you ask us to do, to remember that. So we remember. We'll come and we'll confess, Lord, that we aren't perhaps what we should be. But your blood washes and cleanses. And as confession's made, there's that cleansing power that's applied. So part of us that have been dirtied by the world, Lord, cleanse it tonight. We confess it. We thank you for it, the work that you do in this time. How awesome it is to come to the table and allow you to do that work again. So bless this time. Thank you for your word. We commit this time to you in Jesus' name. Amen.